Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of elite mountain biking. Welcome to episode 20. I really can't quite believe that we've got this far, to be honest. I set myself the target of making at least 6 episodes, and it was pretty tough going at the start. It was quite hard to get the guests on, learning how the technology side of things works, working out whether I was any good at interviewing or not. But I think it's worked out about pretty decent. I'm feeling a lot better about it. I find it a nice way to spend my time. I've really enjoyed chatting to the guests, and as a result, here we are at episode 20. I'd like to think that I'm getting a bit better at it, but let me know. Please get in touch on Instagram, where we're Downtime Podcast, on Facebook, where we're The Downtime Podcast, and on Twitter, where we're Downtime Tweets. And if you are enjoying what we're doing here, it would really help if you gave us a review over on iTunes. It helps other people find the podcast and know what we're about as well. So if you've got time, we'd really, really appreciate that. Okay, so this week we've got another fantastic guest for you. It's Mick Hanna. Mick's put in a really impressive couple of years' work getting ready for his hometown World Championships in Cairns that took place last month. He was unfortunately beaten by an on-fire Loic Bruni into second place by only 0.33 of a second, which is pretty amazing. We talk about his build-up to that event, the planning that went into it, as well as a lot about his background and his time in the sport. I found it a really interesting chat. I hope that you guys do too and that you get something out of it. So without further ado, here's episode 20 with Mick Hanna. Mick Hanna, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for taking time out to come on.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
Cool. So before we get going too far into the world of mountain bikes, I think congratulations are in order. Am I right in thinking you have a new baby on the way fairly soon?
Yes. Yeah. Baby's due October 29th. So it looks like it might come a little bit early, which is exciting.
Excellent. Yeah, that's super soon. And will you be having the baby in Australia, or are you heading back to the US?
Yeah, we'll be staying in Australia. My wife and I are both from Cairns, and our families are all within an hour of this area. So it'll be nice to be here with all the family. And we plan to stay here until just after Christmas. The last two Christmases were spent in the US. I've got two kids with my ex-wife over there, and we've all had Christmas together over there, but it's nice to stay home with our own families.
Yeah, nice one. And your boys, how old are they now?
My youngest, Rowdy, is 7, and then the oldest, Duke, is about to turn 9 on the 1st of November.
Awesome. And have they been riding bikes? Is that something that you do with those guys?
Yeah, both guys got on the balance bikes when they were about 15 to 18 months old. Duke was probably 18 months, and then Rowdy, obviously there was a balance bike in the house, and he just pushed it around until he was tall enough to throw a leg over. And ever since then, they've been riding bikes, and now they spend a lot of time on their motorbikes because those are a bit easier to go for a ride. They've got a little field out the back of their house, and they can start the bikes themselves, so they just go out and build jumps and hurt themselves.
Awesome. And so how have you approached teaching them to ride then? It must be quite interesting as a World Cup downhill racer to start working with your kids and helping them learn.
Yeah, it's really been an interesting thing. And I've always wanted kids growing up. It was exciting to have that opportunity. And then to think about putting myself back in when I was that age, and how did I learn, and what are the things that were really helpful or not for me? And I really try to let the kids kind of grow and figure it out for themselves in a lot of ways, and just kind of give them little hints and things here and there. But basically just don't put any limits on them, on their imagination. And if you let their imagination run wild, then they figure it out in ways that you never could. So
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about the pain and them getting hurt? Are you kind of, do you struggle to stop them hurt, you know, to stop stopping them from hurting themselves, or are you kind of cool with letting them find their own way and make their own mistakes?
It's horrible as a parent to think about your kids hurting themselves and to see them hurt themselves, but it is a part of life. And I think these days life is getting quite sensitive, I guess. There's a lot of rules and boundaries being put in place. And to me, I think that's the most dangerous thing to do to a kid. My boys have always, kind of had the rule of thumb that if they can't get onto it or ride it or climb onto it, then they're not, I'm not going to help them up. Mm-hmm. But if they can get up there, then generally it's safe enough for them to fall off. And when they do make little mistakes, I'd rather be there and watch them make the mistake and then they learn and I can be there to deal with it if it is serious. And that way when I'm not there and they are going to do things when I'm not there, as we all have done, when our parents are gone, we do the worst stuff. So, yeah, then I think if they've learned with me there as a kind of protector and being able to save them when things get serious, then when I'm not there, they're more likely to be able to handle themselves in a healthy way.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a really nice philosophy. It makes a lot of sense. So if we wind the clock back to when you were kind of that age, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into riding?
Well, when I was born, we lived out on a farm, and those first 6 years of my life, obviously I wasn't riding the first couple of years, but when I was about three or four, I started riding bicycles, and then Dad came home with a little 50cc motorbike one day, and he said, "You take your training wheels off, you can ride the motorbike." So I took my training wheels off. It was pretty simple scenario for me. Of course, I want to ride the moto. So, and then I remember riding that moto for hours and hours and hours, and we had a lap around the house, and I still remember that track to this day. I remember all the lines, and there was a particular corner that I used to drift, and I just remembered trying to hold the slide for as long as I could, and when I lost it, I clearly remember just hanging on to the throttle, making sure it doesn't stall so I didn't have to start it again. And yeah, that was the beginning, really. I loved going fast, and my dad, he enjoyed motorbike riding, and they had old bomb cars they used to rally around the farm. And so kind of grew up with that kind of culture and enjoying that sort of thing. And then when I was six, we moved into a town that was closer to where Dad had work. Dad had seasonal work, and we lived at the caravan park in this town during the working season for Dad. And we eventually moved to that town, and a BMX club started up, and I started racing BMX. Just kept asking my parents until they took me to the race, and now here we are.
And how did that transition from BMX into mountain biking then? How did you stumble across the mountain bike scene?
Yeah, well, I raced BMX. We lived in Victoria, in the southern part of Australia back then, and I raced BMX until I was about 13 or so is when I transitioned into mountain bikes. And I did quite well at BMX. And when I was 11, we moved up to Cairns in the northern part of Australia. And I had raced BMX for a long time, and I'd won a few national titles and believe it or not, got second at World Champs. And then I went on a Christian mountain bike camp with my BMX, and I met a guy there my age, and his father had a mountain bike tour company, and I really loved the camp, loved the mountain bike riding and the kind of the culture of it, I guess. BMX is a bit high strung, and the mountain bikers are all really just good mates trying to ride the gnarliest stuff they can find in the woods. So I was attracted to that, and Stephen and his dad took me to a couple of mountain bike races and allowed me to ride the tour bikes from their company, and yeah, that's how I got into mountain bikes. Nice. Just that camaraderie and the fact that one of my best mates is the one that brought me into the racing scene, and we, at that age, we were the two fastest guys around here, and just really enjoyed it, really enjoyed the lifestyle of it, I guess, and the type of people that race mountain bikes.
Cool. And was it always the gravity-fed side of things? Were you throwing yourself down hills in the woods, or was there a kind of cross-country element as well at the time?
Well, the first few races we raced, what we call a Pony Express over here, which are cross-country races, and you do it as a team. So myself and Steven race as a team, and you do a lap, like I do a lap and he does a lap, that kind of thing, sort of a relay, 2-hour relay race, I guess. So that was more of a cross-country side. But and then we went downhilling and kind of just went finding, sometimes doing downhill runs and sometimes just finding big lines and stuff in the woods, wherever I'm building new trails. And it's kind of, I wouldn't say it was one way or another. I raced quite well at cross country and raced quite well at downhill. And it was just, it's just mountain biking, isn't it? So for me, it's kind of sad to see any separation between the disciplines. I really enjoy cross country and enduro and downhill. And to me, it's just mountain biking.
Yeah.
I prefer World Cup downhill is my passion, but I enjoy all aspects of mountain biking.
Cool. And how many years is it now that you've been racing at you know, World Cup level? It's a good few, right? I've lost track.
Yeah, my first year was 2001, and I had a year off in 2008. So this year was my 16th World Cup season.
Awesome. Yeah. I was going to ask actually about your year out. Was there ever any doubt that you'd come back? Was it always an intention that, you know, you just wanted a break from it, or, you know, how were you feeling at the time?
Now, at the end of 2007, I was quite stressed actually, and quite stressed at home in my personal life and also with racing. I hadn't been doing the training that I should be, and then that obviously leads to a lot of stress at the races, and I was just yeah, I don't know. I was done. I couldn't handle it anymore. And when I decided to stop, I quit racing. It wasn't, I didn't have any intentions to come back. I didn't feel like I was having a break. I just went to work and really enjoyed working. And even when the idea started to come up of coming back racing, it was just a couple of my friends that were kind of said to me, what are you doing working for $100 a day on a farm? You should be out racing your bike. And so I just put a message out there to a couple of people that I knew in the industry and said that I'd be interested if there's any rides available, and just left it at that really. I didn't really care one way or another if I came back or not, and a great opportunity came up and I just took it, and then finished second at the first World Cup that I raced that following season, 2009. And 2009 ended up being one of my best seasons ever. So that kind of confirmed that I was supposed to be there, and I certainly loved it. There's a lot less pressure because I just let it kind of come naturally, and now I'm enjoying it more than ever now.
Awesome. Yeah, it's really good to hear. So 16 World Cup seasons, it's a long time. What have you learned about yourself over those years? Have you kind of discovered a lot about yourself and been able to improve your ability to race at that level and also to enjoy it, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really tough question. We don't have enough time to answer it fully, I would say. But one thing is, ever since those days doing laps around the house when I was 4 years old, that's been my passion, being on the edge of my grip and the edge of the speed that I can do any particular course. So I guess the biggest thing I've learned through getting into that stressed place in my life and having a year off and being able to come back in, I'm not going to say an easy way because there's a lot of work behind the scenes that goes into it, but it's very natural for me to race at that level when I've put the work in. And it's just when I get to the bottom of the hill and I've had a good run, it's just the most amazing feeling you could ever hope for. And I think there's been times where I've questioned whether I should race or not, and the biggest thing I've learned is it's right in front of me. And you kind of, if you have a questioning what you should be doing in life or anything like that, it's quite often it's right in front of you and you're looking at every other option except the one that's right in front of you. And quite often that was the case for me. And I feel really lucky to have gone through those kind of questioning years and taken that year off and being able to come back from that. And now that I'm enjoying it so much, it's it's helped me to reflect on my whole career in a lot more positive way than I was at that time where I was at those low points.
So has your riding style changed much over those 16 years, do you think?
I think my core riding style is always going to be the same. The kind of things that you're interested in and the things that you enjoy on the bike, those are the things that are kind of the foundation of what makes you fast. So essentially that doesn't change, but then there's some refinements, and obviously you have to adjust to the course changes and the technology changes. And so I think in some ways it has changed, but I'd say it's probably more refined than changed. Mm-hmm. And there's certain things, like you look at the World Cup schedule some years and the courses are a bit different, or the weather might be a bit different, which is, the weather's not something you can plan on, but you can certainly look at the courses. And I would love World Championships, so each year I just look at what the course at World Champs is like and kind of aim your training around that. So there are little things that are different, but essentially when I look at old photos or videos from when I was racing BMX and look at photos and videos from World Champs here in Cairns, there are a lot of things that are really have never changed over the years. And in some ways, I think you can get trapped in looking at Aaron Gwynn or Danny Hart or Greg Minnaar or Steve Peat or any number of other great riders and think, oh, he's flying, I need to be doing what he's doing. And that's just not true. There might be elements of what each of us good riders are doing that are great, but and that you can use yourself. But for me, I've had to learn that I am quite a good rider, and I've got to remember that there's elements to me that work for me and they won't work for anybody else, and I need to stick to those.
Yeah, that makes sense, definitely. So let's talk about that, the 2017 Worlds then in Cairns. So the Worlds is one of the few races that gets kind of announced the venue and date a long way ahead of it actually taking place. So you'll have known for a good while that 2017 Worlds was going to be in your hometown effectively. When did your build-up for Cairns World Cup kind of start, and how did you go about approaching that?
Yeah, well, I guess I heard quite early that they were considering putting in a bid, so I knew that it was a possibility quite a lot earlier than you would normally find out about a venue. And yeah, it's a really interesting kind of mental road that I've gone down along that period of time. At the time, I wasn't doing so well in my results. I'd had a couple of injuries that had got my confidence down. And when I first heard that Worlds were in Cairns, I thought, oh, maybe that's a good opportunity to like have a good race and enjoy it and then retire from there. And thankfully that's changed. Like after a little while, I figured out that I want to keep racing. And when you aim at a race like that and get yourself back up to the level that I know that I can be, then it's a lot more fun to think about racing for a few more years. So the preparation for Cairns, it's hard to know when it like really started, but I would say 2 years ago is when our plans started to really be aimed at Cairns. And that's also a hard thing, because you need to start planning that early, but also you don't want to overcook yourself too soon and peak too soon. Yeah.
And were there, so you, to put together that plan to get you to Cairns, I guess, are you looking at the specific demands of the Cairns track and then tailoring your training towards that? Or is it more like a general fitness and riding skill and ability program? How does that look? I mean, what does that look like, I suppose?
Long term, the preparation for this race was more of a mental thing, and not just being able to put a run in for those 3 minutes, but staying, like making the decision of whether it's good to stay at my parents' house or not, because they're just 5 kilometers from the venue, and it's a great place to stay if we can structure it at all in a healthy way, because everybody's quite nervous and everybody reacts a different way, and then when that can be tough when you're with your family. And from the other side, you can also get too comfortable staying at mum and dad's house and playing with the dog, and that, all that, like, can be a bit too normal and kind of take your intensity away from the race if you're not careful. So had the opportunity to race 2 World Cups before the World Championships, which was a great chance to learn and grow in that. The first World Cup in 2014, I think I really didn't do very well, but the main goal for that race was to learn as much as I could about what it meant to race in my hometown. Mm-hmm. So I'd say long term, that was more what was involved with the lead up to Cairns, just learning how to race at home. Just not many people will ever have that opportunity, and it's something that is mentally really a lot more difficult than a normal race.
Interesting. So did you
change? And then physically.
Sorry, I was just going to say, did you change very much from the way you set up in 2014 at the World Cup through to 2017 World Champs? Did you change much about how you approach it with, you know, where you stay and how you handle the week?
Well, where I stayed didn't change. I made the decision to stay with mum and dad, which I'm really thankful that I did. That was the best place to be. But then there were media and things like that that I really had to just cut out. It's a great opportunity and you feel like you need to make the most of that kind of media opportunity. We are in marketing after all. So,
yeah.
But that first race, I really got way too busy and there was way too much pressure, and I said yes to too many people, basically. So that was a big part of what I learned, and also an opportunity comes up with being at home to surround yourself with the best people possible. When you're racing overseas, you don't have the opportunity often to surround yourself with really close core friends and healthy people that can help you stay in a healthy mindset for the race. And so I made the most of that opportunity, and mum and dad's house had a lot of people in it, but they were all people that I had intentionally placed in that to be around me and to have a good core group around me for that race week.
Cool. That's really interesting. And you're going to move on, sorry, to talk about the physical prep side of things.
Yeah, the physical prep side is, like, I'm always learning and growing in that. So I wouldn't say that there was a lot different for this race compared to any other race that is important to me. You kind of just look at the course and figure out the types of things you need to do to apply to that course and try and do that. So that physical side was just mainly being patient and waiting and not getting stuck into it too soon. And because we have a good base level of strength and fitness anyway as professional athletes, and to taper or to refine that for a specific course doesn't take too much time really. So being patient with that and trusting the people I chose to have around me.
And what are the specific elements of the Cairns track that would require a change in your physicality? You've got a pretty heavy sprint right at the bottom of the track, but is that the only thing that you kind of focus on in addition, or are there other elements that you'd want to improve?
Yeah, well, there's, for Cairns specifically, there's the climate, obviously. It's a hot place. So learning to be really good with your recovery and maintaining your energy and health throughout the week, that's one thing that was important to learn. Racing in a cold place is quite easy, actually, because your body temperature stays, your core temperature stays low. Like, can be a bit of a challenge to stay warm enough not to get sick, but as far as recovery goes, your body stays in quite good condition in a cold place. In the heat, it's, you have to be much more intentional about that kind of thing and not let yourself get heat exhaustion every day, you know. So, mm-hmm. And then Cairns it's more like kind of a pitch of Mont Saint Anne or a place like that that's not necessarily the steepest, but it's quite fast. So some places like Champery is an extreme example. The small guys do really well. And in Cairns, it's not so important to be as small, like to reduce body weight or anything like that. A lot of power and timing. It's a really precise track. And there's also, some different sections, and you have to choose which one is more important, which one is the highest percentage that you can get a benefit from. For me, the pedal's only 15 seconds of a 3:20 track, so it gets quite a lot of focus in the media, but it's really not that important in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, looking at the splits, it seemed that certainly the top section of the track was where you and Tracy were really able to put some time into the rest of the field. Like a familiar.
Yeah, it was interesting. And bike setup was a lot different on this track than the average World Cup track. And I think that's where you can see someone like Loic, who puts a lot of effort into the data acquisition and all that, and is really good at bike setup at individual courses. I think he can get a good benefit out of that. And we spent a lot of time on bike setup as well. And I know a few of the other guys were like that. And I think that's a good point, is you can get that kind of benefit in at any kind of track if you really pay attention to what setup is good. And often the tracks certainly Cairns, there's, like I said before, there's sections that are really different from each other. And you have to choose kind of the benefits and compromises that will work the best on average through the whole course.
Yeah. And what are the main things that you're changing on your bike then to get set up for a track like Cairns?
Well, there's a few sections on Cairns particularly that are quite tight, and some tight turns at the top, and then down the bottom there's a few tight turns as well. But to set up for tight turns, it really compromises the stability of the bike at high speed. And Cairns is also probably the fastest section on the World Cup. So you've got the slowest, tightest, most technical spots as well as the fastest sections. So if you can set your bike up so it's good and in those slower, tight sections and still be able to hang on to it when it's fast, then that's the way to go.
Cool. And talk us through the week a little bit. How did it go from your perspective?
I'm really happy with how the week went, apart from the fact that I've missed out on winning by a fraction of a second. But everything, the planning and everything that we did went really well. The mental preparation, and we had some good trainers and physiotherapist, and then the team, obviously the Polygon UR team was all there as well, and our family, and everyone knew their job, and everyone did their job really well, and we were all able to just enjoy it together. And it's downhill can be seen as a very individual sport, but for Tracy and I, through World's Week, it really took a team of maybe 20 people to take care of everything. And for sure, you could do the race without that kind of support, but when you're talking fractions of seconds, and it's also not just the benefit of having those guys working together, but the value that the race has for us when you're able to share it with good people around you is really important.
So you're able to enjoy the week as well as put out a pretty amazing result.
Yeah, and that was something that I really tried to focus on, is the opportunity to be at the level that I'm at right now, at the stage in my career, having been able to race for so long and to have world championships hometown is like, that's not even a once in a lifetime opportunity. That there's not many lifetimes that you get that kind of opportunity. So I really wanted to make sure that regardless of the result, that I enjoyed the whole process, and I really did that. It was an incredibly enjoyable experience, from the preparation to race day, and then to have all my friends and family and people that have supported me for so long back here, as well as thousands of people that I don't even know, just in there enjoying it so much and screaming and crying for you. It's just, yeah, I definitely feel really lucky to be able to experience that.
Yeah, cool. It's really cool. So 1994 BMX Worlds silver, 2009 Canberra bronze, 2013 Peter Maritzburg silver, and then 2017 silver. the comparisons to PT, I guess, start to come along.
I got silver in 2000 at seniors as well.
Ah, yeah, of course. Yeah, I missed that one. So, yeah, comparisons to PT. Are we going to see a Won't Back Down, the sequel? And do you think the opportunity is still there for you to get the gold? And we've got, is it Lenzerheide World Champs this year coming?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to keep trying. Sitting in the hot seat and having Loic come through and just get me by next to nothing is something that I've felt, obviously, a few times before. And I was wondering what I would feel at that point, like the whole lead up and everything. Obviously, it's exciting to think about racing the next couple of years when you think I'm going to be world champion. And then when I also had the thought leading up to the race, like, how am I actually going to feel if I do lose the race after trying so hard so many times and feeling like this was such a good opportunity, probably the best opportunity I've had in my career to win a world champs. And as soon as Loic crossed the line and put me into second place, the first thing I thought of was, how can I win in Switzerland? So that was a really encouraging kind of reaction that I had. And I was interested to know how I would react in that situation. I was just thinking that I've got five world championships in my lifetime, and the combined losing margin is less than 2 seconds. So I've been incredibly close over an incredibly long period of time. And you brought up Petey, to be kind of compared to Petey in any way is really humbling. He's just a legend. So he was 2 years older than me when he won in Canberra. And so I've definitely got some time left, I think.
Excellent. Well, the film crews better start following you then for Won't Back Down, the sequel, so that there's plenty of footage around for when it happens. Awesome. Good stuff. Yeah. So it sounds like you're definitely, you're not thinking about quitting for a good few years yet then.
No, and obviously at this stage of my career and being around for so long now, my first year, I thought, man, I hope I can do this for 10 years. And that was 17 years ago. So now they're just bonus years. And I can't say how long I'll race for. I know that I'll race for the next 2 years. That'll be, we're about to sign contracts. All our contracts are up now and it's time to renew. So I definitely want to put an effort into racing the next 2 years, and then we'll just reassess at the end of that.
Nice. So you've got a pretty mixed team of riders with Polygon United Ride. It's a big team and a lot of different people in there. Do you enjoy kind of mentoring the younger riders that you've got around you on the team?
Yeah, I do enjoy that side of it for sure. I get so much joy myself out of improving my riding and improving those things that I'm so passionate about. And if I can help the younger riders coming through to be able to kind of let go of some of the unnecessary pressure and just focus on improving those things that really bring joy and the passion to them, then that's what I enjoy about it. When I think about coaching or mentoring, kind of moving on to that next stage of life and my career, I guess, it really doesn't bother me if I'm coaching somebody to win a world championships or not. I really enjoy working with people who just want to improve themselves and have more fun on their bike. And I just had that experience with one of our trainers yesterday. I took him downhilling for the first time on a downhill bike. And obviously he's not trying to win a world championship, but just to go from one run to the next and see the improvement and see the smile getting bigger, that's what I enjoy so much. So
nice one, yeah.
I'd really love to share that with the younger riders who are at that kind of top end of the World Cup level. I really want to be able to share with them that if you just relax and do what you do and just be yourself and try to improve yourself a little bit every day, then that's the best way to do it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what are your most commonly given pieces of advice to these guys and girls? That's obviously one of them. What else comes out a lot? What other themes are there?
That's pretty basic, really. I mean, it's just remember why you do it. Remember why you used to get up in the morning or lose sleep overnight, being excited to get out on your bike. And don't forget that feeling, because there's times when it does get incredibly hard when you're injured or you're having a string of bad luck or whatever. And it's really helpful to be able to reflect on those moments where I used to be staying at my buddy's house and there was a photo of John Tomac up on the wall and we couldn't sleep all night and we were kind of worried that we were going to be no good on the bike the next day because we didn't get any sleep because we were so excited. And just remembering those times, and that helps you get through the hard times. And then this, like, nothing worth having is easy. And you really have to work hard for what you want. It's not something that's given to any of us for free.
Yeah, very good advice, very good advice. And you always seem to manage to throw a bit of fun into all of your World Cup runs by finding somewhere to throw a no-hander. How did that come about? Like, where did that start?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question that's kind of goes along with what we were just speaking about. I was actually, where it started was in Lourdes in France. That's a course that I've struggled with. I really love the course and I do reasonably well at it, but it's definitely one of my harder courses for the year. And this particularly, I was struggling with my confidence anyway. It was coming back probably the year after I had my shoulder surgery. And in all throughout practice and qualifying, I was just so stressed and tense. And for my race run, I just, like, speaking with my suspension engineer at the time, and he was like, you just need to trust yourself, basically, and relax and have a bit of fun. And I sat in the start gate for the final, and that was my goal. I didn't think anything about the time. I just wanted to enjoy my bike. And as I was just saying, you have to remember those moments and remember why you do it. And I didn't even have any idea that I was going to do a suicide in my mind in the start, but I got down to one of the doubles down there and halfway down Lourdes, and the crowd was all going for it, and I just quickly threw a suicide, and and it's kind of stuck. So it's also like being able to be successful at World Cup level is just a personal thing for me, really. And the reason we're there is for the fans and for the people that support us. And I think to have a bit of fun during the races and put on a bit of a show is the main reason that we're there. And we're there to inspire people and put smiles on kids' faces. So that's also the other part of it.
Yeah, it's awesome. It definitely works. It's cool. Are there any tracks where it's been tough to find somewhere to throw a cheeky suicide, or is there always a jump ready for it?
I wouldn't say there's always a jump. Probably the most risky one I've done would be at World Champs in Val d'Isère last year. As you know, there's no jumps on Val d'Isère. He's a traditional old Italian downhill track builder. So, and I came into the finish and there's just like a little finish jump. And I threw a quick one there and you're not in the air for very long. And I think I was probably on the ground before I got my handlebars back. But that was again, like most runs, I don't plan on it. I just hit a jump and feeling good and let go of the handlebars real quick. So that was definitely one of those cases. I didn't plan to do a suicide, but I'd had a good run and crowd was all screaming and just kind of felt like it.
Awesome. Love it. Keep it up. It's good stuff. So we got a couple of questions just to sort of wrap up that we've asked to most of our guests so far. And the first one of those is, if you could wind back the clock and visit your 15 or 16 year old self, is there any advice that you would give them?
Yeah, the one thing is you've got plenty of time. I was definitely in a rush when I was that age, and I think a lot of people are. And I see young kids now, and they're in such a rush to try to get fast. And I think you just need to keep enjoying your bike, do the hard work, but not burn yourself out mentally. And that's what I would like to see. Those first couple of years for me, when I was on the professional circuit, I'd worked so hard and pushed so hard for so long before I got there, and kind of people think you just suddenly broke out and got some good results, but there's a lot of history behind that when you get to that point. And I think it was quite a few years before I had the motivation to start training properly again. And I did well, really well at the start of my career, and I kind of tapered off a bit, and then I got the motivation back over time, and now that's showing towards the end of my career. But yeah, if I could have relaxed a little bit more and came into my career with a little bit more mental energy, then I think that would have been really beneficial.
Nice. Yeah, good advice. And then the final question is, if our guests had around £100, and I haven't converted that into Aussie dollars, so I'm not quite sure what it is, but let's say $100 US, because that'll work for you. If our listeners had $100 US to spend on something to improve their performance on the bike, be that a gadget or a bike part or, you know, clothing or training or whatever, what sort of thing would you recommend they spend the money on?
It's really interesting. I would say a free lap stopwatch. If you could get one of those for £100, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much they are now.
But that's as a downhiller, we race the clock, and we are racing against ourselves, and the clock is the way to measure that. So it's too tiring mentally to do timed runs every day, but you definitely need to do timed runs consistently.
Yeah, cool. Good stuff. Yeah. Nice one. So if people want to find out a bit more about you, Mick, and follow you over on social media, what are your social media links?
Sick Mick. Trying to think. At Sick Mick on Instagram. SickMick83, I think it is.
Yeah.
And then Mick Hanna on Facebook. Or Sick Mick Hanna is my fan page.
Cool, good stuff. We'll put the links in the show notes over on our website so people can find those as well. Good stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for taking the time today.
If you go to the UR Team Facebook page, is a good place. They have lots of videos and stuff.
Cool.
And you can always know what's going on there as well.
Nice one. All right, we'll add that on. Perfect.
Yeah. Well,
we wish you all the best for the 2018 season and beyond. And I'm looking forward to the sequel of Won't Back Down with Mick Hanna. I think it's going to be a good movie. Nice one.
Yeah, never give up.
Good stuff. Cheers, man. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, that's it for episode 20. I hope you've enjoyed it. I know I really enjoyed chatting to Mick. If you did, head over to iTunes, give us a review, let us know on social media, you know where to find us. Okay, well, we've got another great guest coming up on the 31st of October, but until then, get out and ride.